A Blackboard talk. It's a pretty, Anish Manohar and I, neither of us are really experts on Higgs physics. Mostly we've done QCD type physics and other things. But since we're entering the LHC era, it's time for the more phenomenological people to start to think about that. And when we started to work on it, we realized something that surprised us a little bit, and that's what I'm going to talk to you about today. So let me just set the stage a little bit. At the LHC, the dominant production mechanism for the Higgs boson is two gluon fusion. So it's glue, and then at lowest order at alpha s, you have a top loop. And out comes the Higgs boson. And this is the dominant production mechanism by a factor of 10 to 100 over most of the Higgs mass range. There are other production mechanisms which are subdominant. For example, quark scattering through a W boson, and then the W boson radiates the Higgs. And one sort of just simple way to remember what's an interesting branching ratio or what's a measurable branching ratio, apart from issues with backgrounds and stuff, which I'm not a jock at, probably you aren't either, is about a million Higgs in 30 inverse femtobarns, which is, let's say, 3 years. So that's how many they're going to make. So if you have a branching ratio like 10 to the minus 6, that's tough. So the purpose of my talk is to get some sense as to how much beyond the standard model physics can impact the properties of a Higgs boson. And it seems like there's two ways to approach this type of problem. One way is to just take one of the favorite extensions of the standard model. Well, low energy supersymmetry is by far the favorite extension, and work out properties of those models. And the other is to try to take a more model independent approach and do some sort of operator analysis. And that's the approach that I'm going to take in this talk. And I'll try to motivate taking that approach over the next few minutes. Well, there's another thing in addition to production of the Higgs boson we should know a little bit about before we start. And it's one thing to make it, but you got to see it too. So we should talk a little bit about how the Higgs boson decays. And this is the predominant production mechanism through almost all of its mass range. But which decays dominate is very much dependent on the Higgs boson mass. And really, what it boils down to is it above 2W and 2Z threshold to make real W's and Z's, or is it below? So much of what I'm going to say is most relevant if the Higgs boson mass is below the 2W threshold. So what is the way we're going to see the Higgs boson, hopefully, if it's below the 2W threshold? Well, the decay that is most promising to observe the Higgs boson, at least first, is the Higgs decaying to two photons. And that proceeds at one loop. Of course, I mean, I only drew a one-loop graph there, but there's radiative corrections to that. To the production case, actually, the power series, the production cross-section has been calculated at this order and alpha sq, two order corrections, and it doesn't converge that fast, actually. The first order corrections to this are the corrections to this process are very important, around 20%, and it's thought that even at order alpha sq, so we've done two loops and now three loops, that there's still maybe as much as a 5 to 10% uncertainty just from pure QCD in the production cross-section for the Higgs boson. And that's not to talk about, I haven't even talked about other things like how well we know the structure functions, for example, which people talk about introducing perhaps as much as another 5% or maybe even 10% uncertainty, depending on who you talk about. But we'll imagine for this talk that we know the production cross-section, let's say, at the 10% level. So, you know, if you're talking about new physics affecting this at 1%, it's irrelevant. We don't know it that well, and we probably never will at the 1% level to see such a correction. Okay, so how does it decay? Well, in the low mass range, the way people talk about observing it is through the gamma-gamma channel, and it comes from two Feynman diagrams, at least at one loop. There's one with the W boson, there's one with the top quark, and it emits two photons. And the branching ratio is not that big. The branching ratio is like 0.22%. So out of our million Zs, we're down to like 1,000. Out of our million Higgses, we're down to like 1,000 before we even talk about backgrounds and efficiencies and things like that, or a few thousand in a 3-year time frame. But nonetheless, this is the channel that if there aren't other particles that we haven't yet seen, this is the channel that we'll first observe the Higgs in. There's talk that you could also see it, even if it's below the 2Z threshold. Man, these are awesome boards. Jeez Louise, there's like a million of them. Wow. Okay. So I don't want to leave you with the feeling that this is the only way we're going to see it. So you could see it also, for example, through Z, and then a virtual Z, which goes to 2 leptons. And then this Z also decays to 2 leptons, let's say. And also through the similar WW channel. But here we're only talking about a handful of events. It's very clean. Yeah?
Just a question of really, sorry, back to the first thing. Since the dominant production mechanism is a loop, supposing that there's a cutoff, 10 TeV or 1,000 TeV or something like that, what set level does that affect?
Not very much. You don't need any renormalization or anything to calculate this, so I don't think it's particularly sensitive to the ultraviolet. But I'm going to actually, the whole purpose of my talk is an issue that is actually related to your question. Sensitivity to new physics at the TeV scale is what this talk is really about, so it's a very good question. And I'll just try to answer it in a different way than the sensitivity of the loop graph. It would still would have some. I've never done that exercise.
I'll show you a question. 3 years, so how many thousands of HDRDCs in Neyland?
Well, I think they talk in 3 years about having a 5 sigma measurement in this channel. So that would nail it.
So we do have to wait 3 years?
Well, maybe not. If we get lucky, as you'll see as I go on, but we'd have to get lucky. And, you know, maybe they'll just see crazy stuff. This is just the standard model Higgs I'm talking about. Maybe they'll see Wienos. Bambinos, Swarks, who knows?
Green men,
that's right. But for the standard model, it'll be a little bit of a long, for a light Higgs, if it's above 160, then it decays to, I don't want to depress you too much, John. If it's above 160 or 180, then it just will go to WW or ZZ at tree level. It's an enormous branching ratio. They'll see it very fast. So this is the lighter one where that channel is not open by energy conservation that we're talking about, taking 3 years.
Since you got interrupted, is your talk going to take both sides of the top word into account? I mean, if you're going to change the production, aren't you also going to change the decay?
I'm going to talk about both of them together.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to change all production mechanisms equally. So, yeah, I'll talk about production through this mechanism and decay through this one. All, of course, you observe is the product of the production cross section times the branching ratio. Now, you might be wondering, in this low mass region, since it's a small branching ratio, what is it decaying to do? It's decaying 90% of the time to Higgs to BB bar. But it's just that's unobservable over backgrounds. And it's also decaying much of the time through the inverse of this, maybe 10% through Higgs to jets, but that's also unobservable. We have to get down to this very small branch ratio before it stands up over there.
So why not leptons? Or maybe you got interrupted for saying, why not just some L plus L minus?
Well, it doesn't, it's direct coupling proportional to the lepton mass, but the branching ratio is just extremely small for white leptons.
I was thinking through a loop or something.
Well, then we'd still have to get the leptons off there.
Yeah. So you could have two W's and a lepton, right? Replace the photons with
Well,
leptons.
We don't, we could have this. I think the best we can do is something like this, where we have the lepton.
Yeah, and can't you close that off with a loop?
Well, you don't want to close it off with a loop, I think. That's just going to cost you more.
All right, okay.
But this ends up being smaller than the loop because...
Really, it's harder to see leptons than photons.
No, no, it's easier to see the leptons. It's just a matter of the branching
ratio.
Well,
I meant in terms of branching ratio.
Yeah, when you put it all together, you could imagine in the 3 years, they'll have 1,000 of these events, but maybe they'll have 10 to 100 of these. So the leptons are important. In fact, this is the way we'll get the most accurate measurement of the Higgs mass. So they're not unimportant, and they're there, and people and the experimental community feels they will be able to see this channel. But the first thing they'll see is that one, and those not, because they have more events in it. When you put all together, when you put the branching ratio together. Yeah, you should feel free to interrupt me. I don't mind. It's okay. I have a very fungible talk. How much I do is, I'll get to the punchline no matter what. Okay, so I want to tell you the reason why I'm going to take a model-independent approach, give you a little motivation. It's something that we all know, but you know, it does make me very nervous. So I'll just mention it. So if we look at, if the Higgs plays a very important role in the standard model, and all of us in this room, or at least probably all of us, think that there'll be physics beyond the minimal standard model. You know, if it was such a great theory, it wouldn't be called a standard model. It would be called some sort of theory. And it's got issues. So what do we think? Well, a lot of us think there'll be grand unification. The couplings seem to meet. We got neutrino masses that seem right for that energy scale. So maybe there's physics at a gut scale. Of course, this something has to take care of quantum gravity, the Planck scale. There's obviously new physics here. Some of us think there's new physics here. And a lot of the reason we also think that there's new physics at a scale m around 1 TeV is based on the hierarchy problem. The fact that if you calculate the Higgs mass, this is just supposed to be some stuff in the loop. This is not really a Feynman diagram. This is a cartoon. At one loop, you get a correction that goes, let's say it's W bosons in the loop. Whatever your cutoff is, if you want to think physically in terms of the cutoff. And so if if your cutoff goes well beyond the weak scale, it gets awkward to keep the Higgs mass light. It's not a problem. It's not a mathematical inconsistency. You just have to tune the bare couplings against the radiative corrections. And so this is really, this problem, the hierarchy problem, has really, since the 70s, I think, motivated almost all the extensions of the standard model that we've had to the better point towards the weak scale. Unfortunately, I think there's a lot more reason to be nervous about this type of reasoning recently than we had in the past. And that's because, at least in my mind, there's another completely analogous problem, which is the cosmological constant problem. So that, if you're very naive, that's just a term in the Lagrangian like this. You expand about flat space, and so this graviton tadpole. And if you ask what your cosmological, let me call this lambda to the fourth. If you ask what your cosmological constant is, that you get from a graph like this, you get something like this. And of course, we know the cosmological constant was small. We always knew it was small. But somehow we hoped it would be zero if we'd understand zero. Because it seems like it's easier to understand zero. But now we're kind of stuck with this awkward number where lambda is an order 10 to the minus 3 EB. And I don't know. I mean, I think if we hadn't done any experiments beyond 10 to the minus 3 EB, we'd be talking about discovering supersymmetry. 10 to the minus 3, I'm sorry. We'd be talking about discovering supersymmetry to solve the cosmological constant problem once we got our accelerator up to 10 to the minus 3 EV. But we know in retrospect that that's wrong.
You don't worry about the hierarchy in the mass in the fermion masses from the neutrinos up to the top?
I'll tell you why I don't worry about it, since this was, of course, just a motivated model-dependent approach, why I'm not doing supersymmetry or something specific. But one reason I don't worry so much about that, first of all, the fact that the neutrino masses are very much smaller, you can understand that within the standard model perfectly. They don't get, with minimal particle content, they don't get mass till dimension 5 operators. And so it's natural that they'd be small, just like it's natural that proton. Natural is a very misused word. I mean natural the way you were talking to your mother. It didn't mean natural, not in a technical sense. It's reasonable that they'd be small, just like it's reasonable that proton decay be rare, given if all you knew was the minimal standard model. Of course, that the other fact that we have a pretty big hierarchy just within the, you know, if you go from the neutrino mass to the top mass, it's a pretty big hierarchy. And of course, there's a lot of parameters, like 17 parameters. I think we're supposed to understand that. I'm not denying it. It may be some more complete theory. A grand unified theory or string theory will eventually explain that. The thing about that problem is it has no mass scale associated with it. It can be solved at any scale because those Yukawas, they just run logarithmically. And so I don't have a sense that it's pointing towards new physics at the weak scale the way the hierarchy problem is supposedly pointing to new physics at the weak scale. We've been remarkably unsuccessful at solving that problem. If I had to give a talk on the fermion mass problem now, I'd still probably end up talking about Fritsch mass matrices. Could have done that in 19 something else, you know, a lot earlier. But I have kind of a funny story about that, actually. When John Crespo and I, we were hired together at Caltech. And so we were sitting together, and we had our offices, Caltech, you know. Gods of physics were at Caltech, and that we were there. And so John said, well, you know, I'm not going to forget what's, this is John Presco, I'm not going to forget what's important. I'm going to remember what's important to work on. So he took what was known about the quark, lepton masses, and mixing angles at the time, wrote them on the typical yellow pads we get at Caltech, and stuck it on this little bulletin board in his office. He's not going to forget what it's important to work on. So, like 15 years later, I come into his office. He hasn't written one paper on neutrino masses and mixing since he's been there. And we're talking about something, but then I look onto his little bulletin board, and the sheet of paper is still there, but the sun has faded everything that was written on it. So the problem went away.
Just a specious comment, but these two major problems in physics, based on
particles
we've never seen.
Yeah, isn't that awesome? Well, I don't know. The graviton.
The graviton, John.
But actually, this is just, I could even treat the graviton classically, and it wouldn't matter for this discussion, right? It's only the quantum physics in the loop.
That's the effect.
Well, I think, you know, the pulsar, I think we can, it's okay. I agree. We haven't seen the quanta of the graviton.
Even in the topological theory of space-time, where there were no gravitational waves, there would be no problem.
It's really just classical gravitational physics here, coupling the matter.
You look at the cones in cross-section, right? So you're going to get one event per lifetime.
No, I know we're not going to do quantum gravity experimentally. I know.
So
we are.
But not that way.
Okay, well, more power to you.
But this has to come into what position?
No, this is just, if I treat the class, this is a classical gravitational field, and it couples to matter, but the matter I do quantum mechanically. I mean, I am assuming something here, I guess. You know, I could just subtract this, I suppose. I'm assuming that vacuum energy gravitates, but I don't know. I think this is okay. At the level of a heuristic discussion to motivate why I'm nervous about low energy supersymmetry at the weak scale, I think this is. So given that I'm nervous about low energy supersymmetry, and you know, it just gets worse after that. I don't want to tell you what we've done. But you already know what we've done. I don't want to review it all. So what I want to do is I want to take a very model independent approach. And the question I'm asking is a very basic question. It's just, if I take a model independent approach, I'm going to assume there's some new physics to the TEV scale. And I'm just going to ask, what's reasonable for the impact of that physics on these processes? And also on this process. Is it reasonable that I could get 30% corrections to this? And I'll explain how I'm going to talk about reasonable as I go on. So that's what we're trying to address. So I'm not trying to make anything really big. I just want to know what's a reasonable expectation for how big corrections could be. And I hope to give you some sense of that during this talk. I'll get to that fairly soon. So if it takes a long time, we don't have to do the other stuff. OK, so the approach I'm going to take is sort of a standard one. I'm going to assume the new physics associated with it are new particles, let's say, with masses that are greater than the Higgs vacuum expectation value. So we're going to have a low energy effective theory after I integrate those degrees of freedom out. That is SU2 cross U1 cross SU3 color symmetric. And I just want to write down the higher dimension operators beyond those in the minimal standard model that can affect those processes. And the reason I'm kind of optimistic that you could get big effects, I like to get big effects, that way maybe someone will pay attention to my paper. If I got just tiny ones, I'd be relegated to, doesn't matter. Everybody wants to have big effects, right? But we got a shot. Because the standard thing you do when you do beyond the standard model physics is that if the standard model physics only comes through loops, then you're more sensitive to the tree level effects that can come through these higher dimension operators. That's why when you do, for example, B physics, they talk about B goes to S gamma as being sensitive to supersymmetry, because that's a one loop process in the standard model. And so you might have a sense that these processes that occur in one loop would be quite sensitive to physics at the TEV scale. Okay. That will indeed end up being the case. Okay, so let me start to write down the operators, and I'll tell you what we know about the operators. And I'm not going to look at all possible operators beyond the standard model that can affect Higgs physics. For example, it gets cut down a lot if I leave out the operators that could affect Higgs to ZZ. And I'm going to leave them out because I have a feeling that it's only the things that go through one loop that I can affect significantly. And Higgs to ZZ is a tree level coupling. So here's the things I'm adding to the Lagrangian that come from the new physics. Oh man, I probably have like 100 more boards under there. I forgot. So we'll go back over there. So H is the Higgs doublet. I won't write them all. You'll get my notation in a moment. Oh, I'll just write them all. It's not that big. Shouldn't be lazy. So this is the gluon field strength tensor. This is the SU2 field strength tensor for the W bosons, and the Z lives partly in here, partly in W3. And then you have the U1 of hypercharge, and BMU is its field strength tensor. And then we have one more operator, which is actually quite different than these ones, for a reason I'll tell you later. And then there's another set of operators completely analogous to these, where you have a field strength tensor and it's dual. So those are CP violating operators. And depending on how much time I have, I'll come back and talk about whether there's any chance we could see CP violation. I'm a little bit doubtful that those operators will be big enough. It ends up that it's not ruled out experimentally. It's kind of surprising. But still, I think that everything points towards it being too small, so I'm going to leave that out, and depending on how time goes, I might come back to it. So just there's a whole other set. We have BB dual and GG dual, and you could put tildes on the coefficients for the CP violating ones. But let's look at the CP conserving ones. So, you know, we got a lot of experiments. The standard model works pretty well. What do I know about these coefficients? And it ends up that without talking about the Higgs boson, you know nothing about this, or almost nothing. So let me explain to you why that's the case. So first of all, remember the Higgs doublet. It gets a vacuum expectation value, and then the Higgs field, at least the unitary gauge, lives down here. It's a real field, and that's it. So let's think about this operator to start with. So I have h dagger h, g mu mu. And if I'm not looking at the Higgs boson, then I should just put in the vacuum expectation value here. Oh, I'm sorry. It's a little bit sloppier. There's a G3 squared here. I separated out the coefficient, the gauge couplings, because it's natural to think that the new physics, it couples the gluons through the strong coupling. And so you'd get a G3 squared here, the strong coupling squared. And similarly with the SU2, you get a G2 squared. So that's why I factored out those coupling constants in front of the coefficient C. So what does this go to? Well, it goes to V squared over 2. And then things that involve the Higgs boson.
Do we care about the signs of these?
Yeah, we care about the signs a lot.
Because of that trajectory?
Pardon?
Because of the first term you wrote? Because if that was the wrong sign, then the energy would not be balanced from below.
Oh, no, no. You don't worry about that. Whenever you add higher dimension operators, you treat them as a perturbation. So you don't worry about ultimate things like, you know, if they were like stability, but the sign is crucial for whether it adds constructively or destructively with the standard model signal for these processes. So the sign is very important.
In this scenario, lambda is supposed to be a small scale? Or?
Lambda is a big scale. Lambda is like a TeV. It's the scale of the physics that we integrated out. These are high.
It's a low scale, so from TeV. Yeah,
well, large compared to the Higgs bear. So, but not like the Planck scale or the gut scale. I mean, if the new physics was just at the gut scale, it would have no impact on LHC physics. You need it around the TeV scale, 1 TeV, 2 TeV. Of course, it doesn't mean it's exactly the mass of a particle integrated out. Maybe it's strongly coupled physics that's integrated out. It could be that the mass of things you make are 5 TeV, even though 1 TeV is the thing that goes downstairs there. It's not a direct one-to-one. Yeah, you'll see when we examine this plot in more detail that it would be very small unless lambda's around the TeV scale. Yeah, from your perspective, that's low. From my perspective, that's high. But we could meet on that graph, actually. So here's the point. Without the Higgs field, what does this operator do? Well, you could just remember the standard, now it comes with the lambda squared downstairs, the standard kinetic term for the gluon is just this. So I just redefine my gluon field to remove this. And it's gone. And to go back to the standard normalization, of course, it affects the value of the coupling in terms of some more fundamental value of the coupling. But all we do is measure the value of the coupling. And so there's no experimental constraint on this term directly without talking about the Higgs or without putting it in loops or something, which would be a really pathetic constraint. So that's kind of a shocking thing when I first realized it, even though it's totally trivial. If you look at this set of operators, this is basically unconstrained. This is basically unconstrained. This is basically unconstrained. But this one is different, right? If I give the Higgs a vacuum expectation value, that picks up tau 3. And so I've got B mu nu, W3 mu nu. That's not a coupling in the standard model. So there will be constraints on that. I can't just reabsorb that into the definition of the coupling constant. So we should talk about the constraint on this, because even though there's no constraint on these, I'm trying not to be too sleazy. If I had to, I'd be sleazy. So, you know, I don't have to view that as a positive trait. So I don't want to make these enormous compared to the constraint on this. So even though they're different couplings, let's look at the constraint on this. Okay? So everybody? So obviously, I mean, when I give this a vacuum expectation value, this is something that goes into the propagator of the gauge bosons. That's the classic thing that was tested in precision electroweak physics. There's a set of parameters, S, T, and U, that characterize all the effects of new physics in the weak gauge boson propagators. And you just look it up in the particle data book, what the constraint is. It ends up that this operator here, it's basically a tree-level representation of the S parameter. This mixing is basically the S parameter. So I'll tell you what we know about that from the limit or on the S parameter. Okay, so it ends up that this CWB, and I didn't invent the S parameter in its standard definition, so it's got this funky minus 1 over 8 pi. Don't ask me about that. And then I get lambda squared over v squared, just because the coefficient has v squared over lambda squared. And so C double B goes like this, and then times the S parameter. And the S parameter, experimentally, is minus 0.13. This seems awesome, like we measured it. But unfortunately, the error is as big as the. So we haven't measured it. We could convert that into a limit if we wanted to. And so if you look at, if you put that in here, then CWB, at least the central value, it's not really a measurement, remember, because of the error, would be minus 0.08. And now I'm going to phrase it as lambda squared over 1 TeV squared. So you can trust me that I put in the numbers right. And V, to get this, V is a number like 250. The reason I want to write it as lambda squared over 1 TeV squared is because we should think of this as something around 1. So this is the, of course, the limit wouldn't be this good, right? You have to add the error. But to get you some idea of the sensitivity of things, let's imagine for the moment, let's just imagine for the moment that this central value was the value of Cg.
Shouldn't be, if lambda is very big, then that makes this very big. Shouldn't make it very small?
No. This is how big you need CWB to get this value of S. So as lambda gets really big, you need a bigger value of C double B. It's kind of a funny way of writing it, I know, but.
It's just rescaling in dimension, it's unit.
Right. Yeah. But I know what you're thinking. You're thinking as lambda gets very big, its effect is small, but that's just saying you need a much bigger CWB to get the same effect as lambda. Okay, so let's imagine that CG was this size. And with this sign. So that it ends up that that would increase the rank of blue Buddha Higgs in the standard model above the value in the standard model by a factor of 4. So jump, you wouldn't have to wait 3 years. You could wait like a year.
So that's a consequence of the second term in the CG?
I'm saying that if we add this to the standard, if we add this to the standard model, yeah. There's another mechanism for Higgs to two gluons.
Yeah, because of that other term when you expand out.
Right.
So that's all.
Yeah, and if I made CG this big,
then
I would increase the rate of production by a factor of 4.
What's the justification for saying that?
What's the justification for saying that? So I haven't told you that it will be that big. That's a calculation. I do the standard model, blue to Higgs, and then I add this operator with the CG. So that's like a tree level. And I square it up and blah, blah, blah. We're going to come back to whether this is a reasonable size for CG or CWB, but this is not, and that's what I did to get that result. Maybe I'm misunderstanding your question.
Well, maybe CG and reality is much
smaller. Oh, yeah, maybe it's zero.
Could be zero.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is always the minus, of course, of trying to do some model-independent analysis. I'm just characterizing operators and what their potential impact could be, what's a reasonable size for operators, and I'm not saying that this physics is there that generates them.
What's the enhancement factor for the other two, BB and WW? Is it similar to
it, no, it's not as big. It's more like 10% effects. And we'll come to, I can tell you the reason why right now. It's because this part of it is just the fact that this is bigger than this. So you're trying to have impact with a bigger standard model piece to fight against. That's essentially the reason for it. But the goal of this talk is not to take this as maybe a CWB of this size is unreasonably large and we shouldn't expect something. So let's keep going a little bit more in this model independent approach and see what more we can say without doing a real calculation. So here's some really sophisticated analysis coming up now. Okay, where is this supposed to be coming from? It's supposed to be coming from some new physics, here it is, new particle. The new particle couples to the Higgs, the new particle couples to gluons, maybe it's a lot of new particles. New physics. And this is supposed to generate my CG. The new physics is associated with a mass scale. Which we call lambda. But the new physics, it has to occur inside some kind of loop. I mean, it might be strongly coupled physics, but it has to occur inside some kind of loop to get this to go, as far as I can tell. And so the natural size for these coefficients is not so large. The natural size for a coefficient like CG is something that goes like a Yukawa square, the typical loop factor. And then some factor associated with the number of degrees of freedom, n. So we're going to imagine that the Higgs couples significantly to the new physics. So it's not like the standard leptons, for example. Yukawa we're going to take in all our analysis to be a number of order one. But still, the natural expectation for CG is something like 0.01. And maybe if you have a significant number of degrees of freedom, maybe something as large as 0.1. Not an enormous number. I mean, it would take something very peculiar in my mind to give us a CG of order 1.
What's the sign of CG?
Oh, I'm going to have a little model. It ends up, it's an interesting question. It ends up that you can build models of the understanding model physics where CG has either sign. And to show you that, I have a little toy model where you can clearly see it depends on the sign of a coupler that's unconstrained. So there's no prediction for its sign. Do you have a question?
Isn't 0.1 big compared to that 0.08?
Yeah.
So.
Oh, no. Well, the 0.1 is not, it's like, well, 0.1 is roughly the same size as 0.08.
Yeah, but I mean, 0.08 already quadruples the.
Yeah.
So 0.1 is big on those terms.
0.1 will have a huge impact on the rate, if that's what you're saying.
Yeah. Good.
But I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's totally unreasonable. So this is the range that we decided to look at. Yes?
Maybe I'm missing it, but if you do that, you might generate this term here. But won't you generate lots of other higher dimension terms?
You'll generate lots of terms, and so we're going to talk about some of the other constraints. What you might generate a three-gauge boson operator, for example. Throw in another gauge boson. What are the constraints on that, you could ask?
No, but that loop that you've drawn, doesn't it generate a whole series of terms that are all suppressed just by lambda?
Yeah, but lambda's a TeV, so I should stop at 1 over lambda squared. I don't have to worry about 1 over lambda to the 4th or anything like that.
Well, I guess I'm not sure why not. Because am I not at the end of the day doing physics at the scale and so on?
Yeah, you're doing physics at several TeV. That's at the center of mass is 14 TeV.
Right.
And so it's actually a pretty interesting question whether you could have new physics at TeV scale and not make those particles directly and see them in other ways. But you know, it ends up that in this graph, the dominant production of the Higgs boson, it suppresses you a lot to make heavy particles, even though you've got a center of mass energy at 14 TeV. So it's hard. You might think about making real. You might think about making the real particles, a pair of them, and then running the Higgs off of it, for example. But the rate for that is likely to be very small. I think that'll be it. Well, I have to get into a specific model to do that. It's actually an exercise that I'm looking at now. But I don't think that'll be. I think there's a chance you might see it. There'll be other production mechanisms open. And probably the most important one is the one you said. If I call this particle the S, let's say, and it couples to gluons, I could make glue, SS, if these weigh a TeV each, and then brand the Higgs off this, for example. But this is going to be tiny, I already know it, because the S is so heavy. And so this is a representation of what you're saying, of the fact that there's a whole power series. But for Higgs, for glue to Higgs, I can just keep the leading operator if I'm looking at that process.
Can I ask another question? You're focused sort of on a certain set of terms that are related to the graphs that you're drawing there. But one of your comments is that, you know, you're getting this small number, that small branching ratio, because there's so many other processes going on that are lost in the background. So,
well, there's not so many, it's just Higgs to BB bar and Higgs to glue.
Yeah. Are there other Higgs BB bar stuff going on that, you know, could, you know, modify the branching ratio as well, that, you know, isn't part of this story?
Yeah, well, my idea was that these would all be small effects if they're suppressed by the TeV scale, at least compared to renormalizable couplings. And so, you know, it's not going to matter so much if we change the Higgs to B. So we have to ask the question.
The point is that when I get to do TeV scale physics, that the effects are not small for many of them.
If I had added this to a tree-level coupling, like if I added the operators that go to Higgs to ZZ, they would be a few percent effects. It's just because this occurs through a loop if they're so large. So Higgs to BB bar also occurs at tree level. Of course, it's proportional to Yukawa. So if I had a mechanism to make that occur without the Yukawa suppression, then it could be significant. So it's now a detailed question about whether the new physics will have the Yukawa or not.
Let me just ask a dumb version of that question. Supposing there were just a couple more generations, heavy generations, so that would add to your loop here, but it might also add to the things that you can't see.
Well, if there were the heavy generation, I would call that beyond the standard model physics, and it would be characterized by this. I'd have to have some way to make the neutrino very heavy, because you know the Z width constrains the light neutrinos.
A whole new generation of very heavy stuff.
Yeah, if you had a whole new generation of very heavy stuff, let's say at the TeV scale, and managed to do that, or if it was like the standard model.
Just another standard model generation.
Okay, well, that's a little bit different than the physics that I'm talking about. I'll tell you why. The standard model particles, they get their mass through the Yukawa coupling itself, and so it's non-decoupling. As their mass gets larger, the rate for Higgs, their contribution to Higgs, to glue doesn't go down. It just goes to a constant number. So they're a little different than the things I'm talking about now. We know exactly how much. For example, I'll tell you right now what the answer is. This thing here is very close to the value as if I took mt to infinity. And so it'll basically, a standard model generation would basically add coherently with this, but it would be more than just the top quark. It would be all of it, right? So it would just be enormously big compared to the.
So that's good for production.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, I mean, to come back to Rob's question, I think it's a very good question. One that I'd like to examine in the future is, can you have TEV physics that will affect this coupling, yet the particles will not be observed directly at the LHC? And my feeling is the answer to that question is yes. Because all I have to do is make this S decay to jets, and it'll be pretty hopeless to see it at the LHC, because we've got jets, you know, they decay to QQ bar. Let's say it was a color octet scalar that decayed to QQ bar. I believe you'd never see it, even though I haven't gone through the exercise in detail. Okay, but let's talk about some other type of constraints that are very closely related to this. It's almost exactly the same graph. Let's say I scratch this side, and I add another gauge boson. Then I would be affecting three gauge boson interactions. And there's constraints from left on three gauge boson interactions and from higher dimension operators. And I should ask, are those constraints so strong that they would imply that I should expect the C's to be much smaller than the range that I'm talking about? Everybody with me so far? We had kind of a long digression there. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about the three gauge boson couplets. I could just sit in this room for the rest of the day and play with the blackboards. Okay, there's two of them that people talk about, lambda gamma and delta kappa. So I'm just going to tell you what they are and then tell you what we know about them. But I think you'll be a little surprised by how little we know about them. I copied this out of the particle data book. You have to wade through a lot of cosmology before you can actually find the particle properties anymore. But anyways, I don't know. I guess we should have a cosmology data book. So this is not written in the terms of SU2 cross U1 invariant operators. It has to do with the history of this subject. But these are operators after the Higgs gets its vacuum expectation value or whatever. I'll tell you what they could have come from in a moment. Because this is supposed to be the photon. This is WW photon, is what W plus W minus photon coupling that I'm going to talk about. And this is not the field strength tensor, now it's the real W boson, the charged W boson. So if you want to write it in terms of SU2 cross U1 invariant operators, this could have come from three field strength tensors that you then decomposed into the photon and the Z. And this could have came from something like d mu, h dagger, d mu, d nu, h. And then another field strength tensor. Then when the Higgs gets its vacuum expectation value, you would get the W boson, the covariant derivative. And it ends up that in the standard model, of course, the W is charged, right? So the photon couples to the W. And so kappa gamma is equal to 1 in the standard model, and then there's some correction, delta kappa gamma. So if, let's say I'm going to do this the same very naive estimate I did here, but I want to do it for the things that for the three gauge boson couplings. The most naive estimate, what would I say? I would say let's just do lambda gamma. Oh, I forgot to tell you the experimental constraint. This one's actually worse known, so let's just talk, partly because the one is known, so let's just talk about what's known about this. We know that this thing is less than 0.2. That's what's known. Not so great, actually. And there's a similar constraint on this one, but let me leave it out just for time. So lambda gamma, what do we think it should be? Well, you know, we have some loop graphs, so maybe there's a G2 squared, a 16 pi squared. There could be a lot of stuff in the loop, so maybe there's an N. Give me an N to make it bigger. And then I don't know why Roberto Pacheco put this MW downstairs in like 1972 or something. That was clearly a jackass thing to do in retrospect.
That's it, of course.
So we got to get rid of it, and we got to put the lambda squared downstairs instead. So we just put the numbers in, and we get 0.2 times 10 to the minus 3 n 1 TeV over lambda squared. Look at this. if I put n of 1 to 10, I mean, this is like a, this process is 1,000 times more sensitive to new physics than that one. 1,000 times. These constraints, they seem ridiculous when I put them like this. Of course, it's actually not ridiculous for experimentalists to do this, because you could imagine new physics that would contribute here and not contribute anything to what I'm talking about. Because I had to assume there was a Giukawa, and I was assuming Giukawa was order one. So I'm not saying it's ridiculous to look at the three-gauge boson coupling, but the values that we've constrained experimentally are enormous compared to anywhere near where we might expect to have such new physics contributed. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about, now that we've set the stage, of the range of CGs that we're going to look at. I'm going to just describe the calculation in the gluon case, and then it goes similarly for the photon, and then I'll show you the, kind of running out of time, so I think I'll just show you the plots after that, and just say a few words. I mean, the other things I had to do that I could have done on the blackboard was I had a little toy model which illustrated the fact that we don't know anything about the signs of these coefficients. You can get any kind of sign just depending on the sign of a coupling. And the other thing that I had a couple of pages about was, well, I said a lot of us believe in grand unification. So what's a reasonable amount of n's to add if you still want the couplings to meet? Of course, we're used to saying that they don't meet in the standard model. You need supersymmetry, but they almost meet. It's actually a huge success without supersymmetry. And if you believe in unification, you might not want to screw it up even more. And so I'll just tell you the answer to that exercise. So it's basically just it's a simple exercise, but it ends up that there's two ways of thinking about it. First of all, the new physics could come in complete SU5 multiplets, or it could not. First case, new physics does not come in complete SU3 multiplets. And let's imagine that I just perturb the strong coupling, delta G3. Then it ends up that you can't have n much bigger than 1. It could be 2 maybe, but all it takes is something around the triplet that actually ran all the way to the gut scale to start to mess up the unification of the couplings. So n could be 3 or something, but you can't make it large. And if you have a complete multiplet, of course, that binds you a loop, basically, because you get it doesn't affect the meeting of the couplings at leading logarithmic level. And so then n could easily be 10. And these things could give you a successful meeting of the coupling. That's the punchline for that part, because we're running out of time. Okay, so let me describe for you a little bit the computation, because actually you don't have to do any work to do the computation in one limit. So, because the strong interactions or corrections are important, I want to be able to add this part to the standard model. So if the standard model is, I shouldn't have erased it. Plus radiative corrections. And what we're adding is just this operator. So I add them up, then I square them. And what I'm going to predict is the ratio to the standard model. And the reason I want to predict the ratio is because lots of corrections will cancel out in the ratio. like, you know, a soft Bremsstrahlung of a gluon up here will be common to both of these. Because this diagram really is generating this local operator, Higgs to glue glue, at least in the large NT limit. That's the dominant effect. So if I think of this, what do I have to do? Well, at one loop, I can just calculate this. I've done it. It's good. It's relaxing. Got to come back and do a one-loop calculation once in a while, because at least I know I can do it. And you can add this, and you can get the right sign. At two loops, you know, there's jocks in this field who can do it in a week. For two loops, for me, though, you know, since I don't use the computer so well, it's a lot of work. But luckily, I can steal the answer, at least in the MT goes to infinity limit. So this has all been done. This, two loops, three loops. The two loops done at finite MT, they compare it with MT goes to infinity. It's a very good approximation. So I can do the matching onto this operator at two loops really easy. And the way you do it is you use the trace anomaly. The fact that the trace of the stress tensor goes, there's an anomalous dimension, but I don't here, but it doesn't matter. At least if we do it, let me talk about this argument at one loop, because it can be extended. So this is the number of quark triplets. So this is the trace of the stress. There's an anomalous dimension down here, but in order alpha s, we don't need it. To go beyond that, we need it, but let me just not write it down. So what do you say to do this argument, at least at order alpha s, the lowest order? You say, well, this is a physical object, and if I go below or above the top scale, integrating out the top, I'm supposed to get the same value for this physical object. And so that tells me that if I go below the top scale, this contribution here has to exactly cancel for this contribution here so that I get the same answer. I'm just doing this in a qualitative way. So what it tells you, basically, is that if you have MT, T bar T, then I can replace this. In order for this to have the same value. And so you don't really have to do any calculation at all. The Higgs, remember, couples like this, basically. The Higgs couples like the Higgs MT, T bar T. And so I just use this replacement for this. And it's this argument, it has to be improved a little bit, because above and below the top scale, the meaning of this operator can change. That doesn't enter in. It ends up till order alpha s cubed, that subtlety. So in the MT goes to infinity limit, I could actually go and get the matching of this onto the local operator to three loops. It's actually, you can look it up in a paper if you want, because people love the stress tension. And so that's what we did. It's important to include the alpha s correction, so we included them in this way. So what do we have? We're going to have the result at order alpha s in the amplitude exact at finite MT. And then we're going to add in the alpha s corrections to the matching in the MT goes to infinity limit. So we don't have those exactly. I won't write down the formula for it. It's not a very complicated formula. OK, so I think that's how we did the computation. We think we have everything essentially to order alpha s squared put in. And now I'll just show you the plots. That's OK. So this one here, this plot here is the first one we talked about. Glue glue, including the new physics, over the standard model value. And this is this CG times 1 to EV over lambda squared. And so if it has the value 0, the new physics, then it's equal to 1. There's no difference from the standard model. And you can see that you don't have to have, you know, a huge coefficient to have very big, of course, it won't really go to zero. Other processes, like the quark-quark scattering with the W exchange and the Higgs, will kick in, and it will be produced predominantly through that, if you were really in a situation like this. What's all this stuff here? I got three curves here. This is M Higgs equals to 120 GeV. The solid is M Higgs equals 140 GeV. And the dominant is M Higgs equals 160 GeV. So not a lot of sensitivity to the Higgs mass. And so, you know, maybe we'll get lucky and we'll have, we'll see the Higgs a lot sooner and we'll know that there's new physics beyond the standard model. Let me talk about the two photon process. You can see that as well. So I've got this coefficient C gamma gamma. You'll notice on the board here there's no C gamma gamma. That's because it's a linear combination of the last three operators that contributes. And so I took that linear combination of coefficients and called it C gamma gamma. It doesn't really matter what they are. So notice the scale is not the same. I have to have a bigger coefficient to have a sizable effect. But even, you know, even here, it's still a sizable effect. And the sensitivity to the Higgs mass is greater in this case than in the glue-glue case. So I don't know whether we'll see agreement with the standard model or not. But I think it's possible for physics at the TeV scale to affect the Higgs production through this mechanism so that maybe we'll see it sooner or maybe it'll be somewhat later. I also think it's possible that it would be very difficult to detect this new physics directly. Of course, that's a very model-dependent statement, depending on how it decays and what precise masses are for the particles that are produced. But I'm sure if we saw something as wacko as a production that's three times that in the standard model and nothing else at the LHC, we'd either get a super-duper LHC and funding in short order, or we get our $20 billion to build a proper linear collider so we can get up to the multi-TeV scale. Thank you. Yeah, you could have some strong coupling.
It doesn't exist. What's in?
Well, you could not see a fundamental particle, but most people think you'd have some sort of strong coupling phenomena, at least, as these unitarity arguments. One thing I'm not 100% sure about is, I mean, it used to be in the SSC days, we'd say, well, we were going to have enough energy, we were going to be certain that we couldn't evade the strong coupling, that we'd see it if there was strong coupling. I'm not so sure that's true now. I've never studied that in detail. So that would be rather unfortunate if it was right up at a TeV scale and we weren't able to see it here. But I haven't studied in detail. It has to be something just on the basis of the unitarity argument to use some strong coupling sector.
Because we can't describe coupling papers in alternative models.
You can. Trust me. Look into his head.
You can. If people look at will. But you might never know whether it's meaningful. Because it could be sitting there.
You can't go arbitrarily high without seeing something. You'll see strong WW boson scatter, nothing else, right? So the particle's not there. So
let's hope this doesn't happen.
Okay.
About the size of these high-dimension operators, there was a paper recently by Akanyame et al. That the signs are fixed by unitarity or whatever. I mean, can you comment on that?
Okay. Not all signs are fixed by unitarity. I do not believe there's any unitarity argument for the sign of this coefficient. That's the fair answer to your.
You said you had models, i.e., UV completion.
Yeah, so let me give an example of a model. Of course, the same question will happen with the model, because it involves a coupling, if they're assigned for the coupling in the model. But I can give the example. Yeah. Well, it's not a bad question. I haven't looked at it seriously. My gut tells me no. But maybe it's worth looking at.
Well, I didn't quite understand the argument, that's okay. What are you doing?
So here's a little model. We add S. S is a color octet and a Higgs and an SU2 weak doublet. And it's got hypercharge the same as the Higgs, a half. So don't get me wrong. This model is not motivated by anything. It has no redeeming features. So I'm not proposing this. S is a scalar. It just gets worse. Every question you ask, it's just going to get worse. Yeah, would have been better if it was a friend. But you know, it's just a toy. Let me not worry about. I can make an equals for this. So it's got some kinetic term. It's got some mass, which we're going to imagine is a number like a TeV. And it's got some coupling to the Higgs. And of course, it's got self-couplings of the S to itself. So I'm imagining that this sign is unconstrained because maybe this is wrong.
Does it come directly to force?
Yeah, I'm going to get to that. Well, I think at least for low values of lambda, this will be unconstrained because you won't turn the potential over. S has got a vacuum expectation. S has got a positive mass squared. So unless lambda is large, I think if you have any sign, it would still be a stable scalar potential. And then, of course, it's got a decay, so it's got to couple to quarks. And whenever you have something coupled to quarks, the general rule is you're toast because you have flavor changing neutral currents. So you've got to say a little more in order not to be ruled out. So I'm going to adopt this hypothesis that goes under the name of minimal flavor violation, which basically says that this new scalar, when it couples to quarks, it preserves all the flavor symmetries and any of its couplings, and the flavor symmetries are only broken by standard model Yukawas. So any of its couplings that break the flavor symmetries would also be proportional to those same small Yukawas. So I'm not even going to write those down because they're small Yukawas, but it could have other couplings that are flavor symmetric. And similarly to the down quarks is another one. So what have I included here? I haven't written out the color coupling. It's an octet. So an octet can sit between an anti-triplet and a triplet. And this is the SU2 weak index here. And I've contracted this is a doublet. And these are the generation indices. And they're summed over. So I haven't broken any of the flavor symmetries here. Now I'm going to assume that the couplings that do break the flavor symmetries have small Yukawas in them. So that they're diagonalized the same time we diagonalize the quark mass matrices. That hypothesis goes under the name minimal flavor violation. So this thing can still decay. And also, you could get new physics from S exchange. Right? These are standard quarks, pre-level S exchange. But you know, maybe these couplings are just small. And this coupling might be order one. And so the sign of the effect now in this model, and all with the S in the loop, then you get H dagger H. My G of power squared becomes this lambda. And it clearly boils down to the sign of lambda. It's proportional to lambda. And it's hard for me to see how this would be constrained given the possibility of these other terms here and the other terms in the Higgs potential. I haven't looked at it in detail. This is at least a concrete model that could be looked at. Any other questions? Okay, thanks for your patience.